Well, tell me what you're, Dr. Montagnier, what you're doing right now. What is your current state?
Well, I'm continuing what I already described the last 2 or 3 years, that we are pursuing the idea that there are structures in water, what we call now structured water or signalized water, coming from electromagnetic...
Signalized?
Yes, signalized, signalized water.
Okay.
Which keeps some memory, I like to say the word memory of water, from DNA sequences. That's, of course, amazing that a liquid can keep an organization like DNA in some structure. But I think there are more and more data coming from physicists showing that there are several possible phases in water. In liquid water. For instance, physicists have shown that the calcium carbonate, which normally crystallizes as calcite, when it is dissolved in water submitted to magnetic field, will crystallize in another form of crystal, which is called aragonite. Much smaller crystals. Actually, many people know that if you treat water by a magnetic field, it will prevent the formation of calcium carbonate in tubing, in plumbing.
Yes.
That's already known. But there are physicists which have been studying this in detail. And clearly, this transformation of water is quite stable. It's quite stable. It could last for months, even years. So this is really showing that water can keep some information, some structure, which we could, of course we had on another compound, which is the calcium carbonate. But now we are coming back to my own work. We have shown that some DNA sequences, first belonging to bacterial DNA or viral DNA, could induce in water some what I call nanostructure, even we have coined it as nanions, which are stable also. And the amazing thing is that they keep exactly the memory of the sequence of that the DNA from which it originates. So this is what we have shown last year and published. Actually, recently, in Journal of Physics, that we can put a tube of water nearby a tube of diluted DNA emitting electromagnetic signals, and after overnight, after injection of specific frequencies, with very low frequencies, starting at 7 Hz. We can induce in the tube of water some structure which can be then recognized by a DNA polymerase called the TAC polymerase, which is used with a technique called PCR, polymerase chain reaction, and retrieve the DNA sequence. Of course, this is tricky, and we have done it many times in our lab, but we want also now this to be reproduced in other labs, with our help first, but also without our help, so that the phenomenon will be established. You know, in science, phenomenon have to be reproduced. The experiments have to be reproduced in order to be part of the general knowledge. So we have, of course, working hard on this, but I think it will come out probably this year.
You have labs then elsewhere, and can you say where?
We have several labs outside France, in Germany, United States, and
that's good.
Maybe China later.
So you have sympathetic people who want to get the results.
Yes, the problem is to find people which at least are open, have an open mind. This is the problem. You know, some people say this is...
it can't happen.
It can, they are mental rigidity, or I call mental... viscosity.
Viscosity.
And
I call it mental rigor mortis.
Yes, exactly. Or when they parties of the day, I call that retrograde orthodoxy. Retrograde orthodoxy. Of course, the most intense signals are coming so far, what we found, from some sequence included in bacterial DNA or viral DNA.
Mm-hmm.
But we are almost pretty sure that at lower level, we can also detect signals coming from the cellular, the human DNA itself.
Ah.
And of course, which sequence are mostly involved in that? This is something we are now exploring. This is something quite new, not published. But we think those sequences which are piloting the others, perhaps, this is a cascade of resonance.
Yes.
Could play a big role in normal differentiation, embryonic differentiation, to
pilot
the shaping of the organs, of the organism.
Right. So the whole original idea of embryology, that there is a guiding field, a biologic field, or different names.
Yeah,
there are
this
different
is
names
not a new idea,
field.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you say a particular sequence with it, or do you think there's a certain segment of the DNA chain that is the radio transmitter?
I think, well, we are exploring the idea that probably there are the repetitious sequence. You know, DNA, the human DNA is made of 3% of genes, sequence coding for proteins.
Yes.
And regulatory sequence. But there are also a high number, maybe half of the DNA, half our DNA, 50%, is made of so-called repetitious sequences.
Yes, yes, right.
Nobody knows.
Nobody
knows what they are for.
Right.
But they are probably the resonance, the resonator. Of some signaling, and they also they can retransmit the signal to other sequences as well.
This idea, I was at a seminar 30 years ago, or in the late 80s, 20 years ago, where this idea it was pursued just in a speculative way, that perhaps the DNA molecule itself is a antenna of some sort.
Yes, yes. Yes.
And you are saying that in some sense.
But this is probably internal inside the cell, you know, so we're picking up probably an extra vibration, not the real inside vibration, which is probably very small, very low intensity, very low mm-hmm. frequency. So we may not be able to pick up this, but by using our system of inducing resonance at a higher level, we might also pick up something and modify the differentiation, for instance. This would be a proof.
But then it would, when we get to that level of driving embryonic development or continued development, then ultimately the whole body has to be a coordinated system of resonances and so
we
forth.
We are constructors, we're plants, you know, we are programs.
We are what?
We are constructed, you know, from a plant program, something which say to each cells you have to be there, you have to multiply.
Yes.
At that stage, to form something mm-hmm. bigger than the cell itself. You know,
mm-hmm.
this is fascinating, actually. We are, you know, probably this comes from, if it is linked, of course it is imprinted in the DNA, it comes from billions of years. We have mm-hmm. The life on Earth have learned how to make this mm-hmm. for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm. In the bacteria, is it clear where the signaling process is going on in the bacterial cell?
In some cases, we have identified the gene, actually, or the fragment, because it's not a whole gene. It's just a small frequency, about between 100 and 300 base pairs, which are emitting the signals. And I have some collaborators working on the structure or the sequence, which is really the source of the resonance.
Oh, you can lyse off the other parts and still get the signal from these several hundred base
we
pairs.
We can fragment the DNA and have the signal. Actually, if we were making too big, it doesn't work. We have to make it. So Of course, we don't know exactly in life how this works, but
yes,
we are studying mostly DNA fragments from the plasma patients, which probably are coming from apoptotic cells, as dying mm-hmm. cells. So they are already fragmented.
Right, and they're already different because they're dying cells. When you, are these signals also in those low frequency range with the 7 hertz?
Yes, they vibrate with very low frequency, but they when you know the what is vibrating after that is the water. The signals
yes.
come from the DNA,
right?
But water surrounds mm-hmm. the DNA
right.
molecule, and then the water vibrates when we excite with a very low frequency. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Starting with 7 hertz, but going back, going up to 10, 15, 50, 100.
Mm-hmm.
And the response to that the resonance response is higher frequency. It's about between 1,000 and 3,000 hertz. Seems to be similar for any kind of DNA, because this is vibration. I would call that the carrier waves of water, where the electromagnetic signaling will organize the water in some structure, which I call nanions of certain size,
mm-hmm.
because you can filter them between 20 and 100 nanometers.
Mm-hmm.
And those structures are relatively stabilized by their own emission mm-hmm. of electromagnetic signals. And they are, in one way, similar to all sources of DNA, but also different at a lower level. Probably there is some modulation. If we take an example, a comparison, it's like the carrier wave, which is used in television, for instance, mm-hmm. for many stations. Then, up on top of this carrier wave, you have modulation,
mm-hmm.
Which is specific of one television station, television emission.
So if you could separate that, you think you haven't gotten quite
yes,
to separating
we,
out the...
we haven't succeeded yeah. yet, but we think we could. Yes.
You have to build what they call in radio, you have to build the detector to take out from the carrier wave the
exactly.
informational
yes,
signal.
Yes, yes.
The 7 hertz is interesting. Of course, one thinks right away of the Schumann resonance.
Absolutely, yes.
Which has to be in ways we don't completely understand, related with living process. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, probably it was important for the origin of life that this emission already was there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is a very low intensity. It could change, of course, it would vary, because this is probably related to the lightning on the surface of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But since now a few decades, we are completely surrounded by electromagnetic waves with much higher intensity and frequency due to our human activities. So the problematic question is, this electromagnetic smog or fog, does it interact with our own life?
Yeah.
Apparently not, because we are still
yes.
alive.
Right.
We live longer.
Right.
And children grow better or higher
yes.
than our ancestors. But what are the long-term effects? We don't know.
No, we don't, do we? But somehow it also implies that we can survive a lot of... We're somehow very specifically tuned then into these... to the frequencies.
No, probably there are protective mechanisms against this, probably against the effect of
mm-hmm.
external waves.
Yes.
Because our brain also is generating low-frequency waves. The alpha waves also at the range of 12 hertz.
Yes. What was it originally that caused you to look at the radio frequency? To go back
well,
and how you got started with it.
You know, this started from some old experiments I made at the Pasteur Institute when I was there, trying to separate from HIV, the AIDS agent,
mm-hmm.
From its possible contaminants, which were mycoplasma, small bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, I used filtration. And I was surprised to find that the mycoplasma filtrate, which had no mycoplasma at all, no mycoplasma DNA, could retrieve the mycoplasma when it was incubated, this filtrate, with human cells, human mm-hmm. lymphocytes. Mm-hmm. So I thought some information, some genetic oh, yeah. information, starting from DNA could be transmitted mm. without DNA. So this is what I thought. I knew, of course, the work of Jacques Benveniste. And,
oh, I see. And so contamination was out of the question? I mean, what the first question one would ask is it possible that there was some contamination, that the sterilization wasn't complete?
Of course, I asked that.
I'm sure you did.
But you, many times, you know, the filter could this be broken yeah. down and so on. No, we checked that. We spent years, actually, on that phenomenon.
Yeah. And it, it was,
no,
it wouldn't it go away.
It wouldn't go away. Mm-hmm. From a small mycoplasma. And we think probably this implied that the genetic information in the filtrators, small DNA fragments of the mycoplasma genome, could recombine and reconstruct a whole DNA, whole infectious DNA, with yeah. the help of human cells.
It really is amazing.
This was yeah. so. I yeah. haven't proven that yet, but
right.
my work is.
You haven't
like makes it possible.
Right. But your other experiments that do prove it. I mean, you have proven the regeneration.
Of, I have proven the regeneration of so a small DNA, but not
parts, yes,
a whole DNA genome. But I think it's possible for a small DNA, small bacterial DNA, which is 400,000 base pair,
right.
or a viral DNA like HIV, which is 10,000 base pair.
Mm-hmm.
Because we did also the same type of experiments for HIV as well. But it's more difficult to show this by filtration because we don't have the proper filters, you know, for small DNAs.
Oh, small you can't, you can't small make virus. A physical filter.
We can, retain the viruses by mm-hmm. filter of 100 nanometers, 20 nanometers. But mm-hmm. you can always say that the virus can is a little bigger, but
yes.
not that bigger than the bacterial bacteria. Mm-hmm. So it could pass through even a 20 nanometer filter.
Mm-hmm. Yes. My first thought, I thought of contamination. I mean, it was obvious given.
Well, contamination, of course, is the word.
Given the rigor of your approach, you would consider that
thousands of times.
Of course. My second thought was something, another thing that, you know, I mentioned to you before we recorded that I have Lyme disease, and having a disease makes you more interested in certain things and maybe things you used to not think about. So, in my research into the Lyme disease, one of the things that I came across was this theory of pleomorphic bacteria. I'm sure you're familiar with that. That was something that was, well, the name, what is her name? Kleeneberger, yeah, Amy Kleeneberger.
Kleeneberger Nobel.
Yeah, Kleeneberger.
I know very well this story because, you know, when I was a young student,
yes,
my first thesis, the part which would be just a bibliography to look at the
yes.
subject, and which I just have to look at the reference and the papers.
Yes.
And the subject given by my boss was L forms of bacteria.
Oh, really?
So I went through all the work of uh-huh. Kleeneberger Nobel, Dinas in Boston.
Yes,
and it's true that they are, well, some people think they are just degenerative forms, but since they can reverse to the proper bacteria, I think they are still alive. And the idea may be that, because they are called L-form or filtering form, you know, because
yes.
they can pass through the
yes.
bacterial filters.
Yes. And so when I read about the passing through filter thing, that was my other thought.
Well,
today, I mean, when I read the Kleeneberger paper, I was so impressed with the thing and how much it had been a part of. It had been a part of medical research going back to the 20s, even earlier when tuberculosis and syphilis were the killer diseases. Everybody was working on that, and those are very both of those. I mean, I think every bacteria has its own little tricks and is very special. But there had been a great deal of study of that. Of course, the relationship to Lyme disease, that's a spirochete, people have proposed, well, that also has pleomorphic forms.
Yes, absolutely.
It has L forms. I wondered if it was possible when you were getting these filtrates, is it possible the bacteria you're dealing with were going into a, had
yes,
been in some other
in
phase?
Yes, but in that case you should be able to detect the DNA.
Yes.
In my case, in the filtration in mycoplasma,
that's
not detect the DNA.
Right.
But it's true that some mycoplasma can show also a pleomorphism, a small spheres of about 100 nanometers. They show that like pearl,
yes, a string.
A string. A string
right.
of pearls.
String of pearls, yeah.
You can see then very well at the electron microscope. Some picture of it.
Yes.
Again, some people say this is just degeneration, but
right.
it is, because they are very regular, and you can see, aside from them, some regular form.
So the PCR technique would make it possible to detect what in the past would be considered a filterable bacteria.
Yes.
They would be detected.
Yeah, the PCR can tell you which how much DNA is in those structures.
Yes. I wondered, I do want to ask you, even if it's a little bit off the topic, do you think that what's accepted today, from what I have been able to read, what's accepted is that only a small number of bacteria, only a small number of species of bacteria are accepted to be pleomorphic. The vast majority are considered not in the general literature. Would you say that, or maybe I'm wrong in that characterization, would you say that's true, though?
We may change this word, actually, by our own attack. You know, we use a lot of antibiotics.
Yeah.
And bacteria, of course, are selected to resist.
Yeah.
So they can exchange, or, you know, they can exchange the formation, DNA for resistance, but they can also stay in form which are invisible to the immune system. And now, knowing that...
Yes.
Knowing that we can form some nanostructure of water,
mm-hmm.
which can circulate in the blood,
mm-hmm.
we can also imagine some DNA information from bacteria or viruses be kept as a form which is completely invisible to the immune system, because it's just water,
mm-hmm.
Also resistant to any kind of antibiotics or any kind of treatment. So,
so
this is another way for the bacteria to escape.
So not simply a visible form, even though it's very small, but actually...
Ghost.
Yes, a ghost. So in that sense, that's interesting, or scary too, because it means a disease could be there and you couldn't...
You cannot detect it.
That means that our medicine will have to advance to the wave phase, let's call it.
Of course, you can detect them by waves.
Means that we could also destroy them by waves if that's what we want to do.
We can also do that, certainly.
And maybe by
in
no
the future,
other means.
Yes.
Yeah.
And maybe this is increasing because of the electromagnetic environment, you know, more electromagnetic waves circulating. More formation of those forms in the blood of people.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many tricks of bacteria can use to resist. Because, of course, we were used at the beginning when they were discovered to acute bacterial infection. But now, of course, we have been treating well by antibiotics, by vaccination. The acute infection, prevent the acute, we are preventing or treating the acute infections. Mm-hmm. So what remains now are the chronic phase.
Mm-hmm.
So bacteria have learned to persist like viruses mm-hmm. in form which are invisible to the immune system
mm-hmm.
and invisible to the treatment as well.
Mm. So going back to the idea of the guiding field, the field that guides the embryo and guides the growth, that must exist in some sense. I mean, from what you were just saying, my first image was of a some kind of coherent radio signal outside, surrounding the embryo in some sense, that has formed itself in some way to surround it and be a pilot, as you called it. Now I'm also thinking from what you're saying about, these ghost images that, here we are, the whole body is a watery environment. Let's think now about the healthy cells. The healthy cells could be, by radio frequency emission, creating at all times a kind of ghost of themselves, that such that the field, in some sense, the field may exist in that form as well. I can't make, this is just a new idea I had, I can't make it more precise. And in some sense, those ghost cells are there also in the blood, let's say, not only the bacteria, but the healthy ghosts.
Yes, I mean, the self is not only the cell we see.
Yes.
Something bigger, yes. Or more harmonious, more organized with the other cells.
Yes.
So it's quite possible.
Yeah. It really gives you it just opens the mind to so many possibilities.
Well, but it helps you solving this is the main problem. The differentiation, they are how an embryo is constructed.
Yeah.
No, we cannot do it. We cannot understand it. We know how to induce the cell differentiation, but we don't know how to make a new organs, a new heart, a new liver, a new brain. But this probably will come if we can solve that.
Right.
We can solve that problem.
Hmm.
So, you know, well, of course this is science fiction, but we can imagine you can prolong the life many hundred years.
Yes.
You can replace your heart. Your heart is used probably more than the other organs.
Right.
Of course, the problem is the brain. You cannot change your brain, otherwise you will lose your personality. But you can at least replace most of the organs and live 700 years, 1,000 years.
So the limitation on organ regeneration now is the conceptual limitation, that people are still thinking simply in terms of elements of the biochemical elements, building block approach.
Yes, yes.
In fact, you have to take that Petri dish with the liver in it and put it in the right radio frequency and light frequency and
you make
whatever
another,
else, and then
you make
the whole
liver.
Environment correct, and then then it grows.
Yes.
Yeah. It's frustrating. It's so exciting, yet also frustrating that we need more. I'm just thinking as you speak, how many people do we have working on this? Not enough.
Not enough, yes. Yeah. You know, it's a beginning of something. At the beginning, there were very few people. When we discovered HIV, we were 10 people believing in HIV.
Oh, that's true.
Millions.
Yes.
So this will come, but I agree that unfortunately there are very few people with very limited means, and this, of course, is slowing down the research on that subject. Mm-hmm.
So you are working on, presently, you would like to get reproduction of this in other labs.
Yes. I think this is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And the second subject is to try to find a specific signals associated with a specific DNA sequence.
Yes. And how does that go? Have you been able to differentiate any bacteria yet?
We are working, we try to simplify the model, you know, a small DNA sequence. Trying to modify it to see when we get the signal, when we don't get the signal. So thinking this is probably associated with some single stranded sequence. You know, DNA is a double helix, but so can open up and form a single stranded structure for each strand.
Are there any hints of breakthrough there yet?
Well, it's too early.
Too early.
Too early to say, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you hear about the experiment recently that was published on the spin selectivity of DNA? That they coated a metal. What was it? They coated some surface with DNA.
Right.
And they fired electrons, I believe, and just.
Right.
The electrons were all of different polarity, or different polarization, spin polarization. But in their interaction with DNA, when they were reflected, they all were reflected with a certain chiral orientation.
Right.
I'm wondering if you were familiar with that, or if you had thoughts about this property of DNA to select certain candidates.
I read this, but I think this was done mostly for application, for computer application, using the DNA molecules for
I think that's how they
storing information or something.
Yeah, but you could reverse. But
I could reverse.
You could reverse it.
I could reverse it. Yes, with water, we have to see the interaction with, mm-hmm. with water. No, this the DNA molecule is a marvelous molecule. I would say it's. Has been, I don't know if it was invented, but really my idea is that the model of DNA was in water. Water can also make helical structure, so we can think that at the beginning of life, at the origin of life on this planet, water may be receiving some wave from the space or by just a random effect could make helix on which nucleotides could be arranged. And this was the beginning of the helix, the double helix. So water was first to create the DNA, perhaps. Of course, once DNA was formed, then it was a magnificent memory because it's very stable and we are built on that. You know, every invention of life was kept on DNA, when of course the proteins were also introduced in the system. But DNA was first, or RNA. Yeah, RNA or DNA was first, but was, I would say, not the real first, the second, second first. The first was water. The water.
Mm-hmm.
But water organized by maybe some waves coming from the space. So you can imagine. Actually, the DNA is not peculiar to our planet. Maybe all the lives in the universe will be made on DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we are not the first, perhaps.
Maybe, yes.
DNA invention came from other universe, other planets.
There are many, many different... There's much evidence on another aspect of this which you're touching on here, which is the question of the interaction of life with cosmic radiation, other radiation from space, that continues. I mean, there were a lot of interesting work done over many years showing. Franco Brown comes to mind. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was an American biologist, active in the 40s and 50s. Just did one experiment after another showing ways that that living processes like the one of the opening of clamshells. And other things. He moved clamshells from a harbor in New Haven, at the sea, to Chicago. And after a certain amount of time, they began to pick up the signal, how they would open up as if they were, as if the tide, as if the moon, the lunar tide of Chicago was being detected by them some way. But he had isolated them from, completely, they were in a box, they were completely isolated from... They still got the signal somehow,
The signal.
The lunar solar signal.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did other things that showed correlations to cosmic ray variations in growth processes. He studied certain plants and so forth. There was a tremendous amount of, evidence there of he and their other collaborators. Again, it's one of those areas that I think we were discussing earlier, like the attack on you. That anything that suggests that life is something cannot be simply explained from the ground up by the laws of physics or by the theory of elementary particles is rejected that there's a tendency for it to be crushed. So this has been your experience, and it was the experience of Gorevitch, really, after why Gorevitch didn't get out.
Well, we are lucky having a system which is very accurate in the DNA sequence. It's chemistry, it's not biology, it's chemistry.
Yeah.
And I think our work also put the emphasis on very low frequencies,
Yes.
Not only looking at cosmic rays.
Uh-huh.
Visible light, but also very low frequency, which
right.
have a very low energy, carry a very low energy, and life may be built on more on very low energy changes.
That the direct coupling is there is to that low energy. The coupling of the, yeah, that,
yes,
that makes sense.
Yes.
And yet it also is employing these others, because the evidence for the biophotons is irrefutable, to in my view. Now, since Gurevich, it has been proven and proven again. The Pop in Germany has demonstrated this over mm-hmm. and over, and other, and then it's been reproduced that there is this biophoton emission at the ultraviolet, in the ultraviolet frequency. Now, that may be a mechanism by which life is operating. It may not be the...
Possibly, yes.
But it's there.
But the problem is, in the manual books, you know, this is executed in one sentence. Nobody has been able to reproduce, so on and so on.
They'll say that? Yeah.
Even like experiments. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I think, fortunately, we're entering in a more solid phase in which we can really prove this, prove the effect of radiation of any kind.
Do you continue to get support in France, at least some? No?
Very little.
But enough, you have enough to carry on these experiments you're describing?
Just about.
And the situation in China is going to take some time.
It may take some time, but we have also support from other countries, you know, mm-hmm. European countries, United States. We have this, those meetings. Mm-hmm. On water, organized by
Pollack,
Gerard yeah. Pollack, mm-hmm. which are very fruitful, I would say.
That's been a help, huh?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, if you had unlimited resources, are there types of experiments that maybe right now are not necessarily feasible or practicable, but that you think could be designed to really, just as a thought experiment, you know, what would be the types of things that you think would be the most exciting you know, applications or experimental kinds of apparatus or?
Now we are working by hands, mostly the dilutions, you know, that's important.
Oh, yeah.
You know, system infiltration and dilutions. But we are thinking of robotize this, make a robot for making mm-hmm. this. So this is one of the goals of our company.
Oh.
And this will extend the possibility to analyze, to use this in practical setting, you know, in clinical laboratories, for instance, to detect and treat early on some chronic diseases, because our system detects the electromagnetic signals from patients' DNA having Alzheimer, Parkinson, multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis. So we can already focus on the clinical diagnosis. This is the way we are trying to make money for employee, extending our resources.
By the way, that implies when you, for example, rheumatoid arthritis is considered an immune, that's not considered a bacterial infection.
It was, but I think
that implies perhaps it is. As there are
any kind of autoimmune disease is caused by an infectious agent at the beginning. You know, mm-hmm. we cannot. Mm. Be autoimmune against ourselves unless mm-hmm. some external agent mimics some of our proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in the case of a bacterial infection or rheumatoid arthritis, the most candidate, this was an old theory actually, that would be a bacterial infection, a persisting bacterial infection.
Yes, and I've read that. I wonder if. So, do you believe that could still be true?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we are working with a group of clinicians in France which are already putting into practice the long-term antibiotic treatment.
For arthritis?
For arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, for the other disease I was mentioning, neurodegenerative disease, and also, and this is also give us a lot of problem, autism.
Yes, which also may be a
it's incredible the aggressive resistant reaction.
Yeah.
You know, we have clinicians, they are general practitioners, but we have also clinicians which have a I would say an academic position.
Yeah.
And those physicians are really scared, you know, to not to come back, to come in our group, not to use too much of our lessons, or because of the pressure from the other side, you know, they may lose their position, may lose their credit.
Yeah.
This is terrible,
yeah,
especially for autism.
For autism, yeah, because, well, partly because it's such an effect on the family, and there's this tremendous
it's a terrible
it's emotional,
disease.
It's an
terrible,
emotional thing,
terrible yeah. disease, and it's in the hands of psychiatrists, and they don't want to hear about infection, organic cause, and so on.
Right.
This is terrible for the parents, terrible.
Right.
The child.
Well, what bacteria is it?
It seems to be common bacteria. This is the our surprise. You know, we look at the species because we have some molecular tools to try to identify. We end with some very common bacteria, like Staphylococcus or Streptococcus. So we are thinking perhaps some strain of those. You know, it's not only the bacterium itself. It's maybe a gene or a plasmid, DNA, which is involved in the disease, not the whole bacterial infection.
I knew a
but antibiotic treatment does a lot against also the bacterial origin.
Yes.
In a study not published in France, we have a recent meeting with 58% of the autistic children were improved, their condition were improved by long-term antibiotic treatment, whatever the cause.
Whatever the cause. Yeah, well, it certainly worked for me with Lyme disease. That was, as I mentioned, I got exploring on this question. I met a old infectious disease specialist. He came up with this idea back in the 60s or 70s and tried to apply it and had some success. That he had the idea that a number of these diseases, pretty much the list that you just gave, were due to a bacterial agent. He thought probably maybe an Ehrlichia, mycoplasma, something very small
bacteria,
something very small. And he was convinced that it was going into the bone marrow. That, you know, because infectious disease specialist is working with a, what is it called? He sent me a hematopoiesis. That he was convinced that that's that it was expressed. It would go in that the infection is in the bone marrow, very hard to get to, and then sometimes expressing itself in the blood, sometimes not. Sometimes you could find things in the red blood cells, sometimes not. But it could stay in there. I wonder if that might.
I think it's an interesting idea.
He had a number of startling successes treating. One of the diseases he treated was lupus. And another one was, I think he said leukemia. It was a terminal case. It was a relative of his. So it got to the point where they just, even though he was the head of the department, they just wouldn't let him do this. They wouldn't let it. All he wanted to do was use antibiotic therapy with people who were dying anyway. That's why I can't understand why they wouldn't, you know. There has to be something else going on, and they won't let him.
But the dogma is you should not treat more than 3 weeks with antibiotics. It's the medical dogma.
Yeah.
Which is completely stupid because it's against the idea is to prevent resistance. But resistant bacteria emerge when you have a lot of bacterial infection, not enough antibiotics. But in that case, you have very low level persisting.
Yes.
Bacterial infection.
Yes.
And a lot of antibiotics, you won't induce resistance in that case.
Yes.
And this is the example of HIV. HIV, you're treating for life with inhibitors on the virus. And in that case, it's like the antibiotic for bacteria.
Yeah.
If you stop, you induce resistance. If you don't stop, you don't have any resistance.
Of course, with John Sides' idea on the AIDS being syphilis, my first thought on hearing that was, well, then antibiotic treatment should work. I looked into it. I found, in fact, there was a doctor in New York who was treating AIDS patients with doxycycline and penicillin, oral, and getting good results for the time that he did it.
Yes.
It was a limited. It was a limited
I came to the same type of treatment, starting from another idea, which was in the early 90s, mycoplasma co-infection. You know. The idea of co-infection is important. It means one agent can be not very harmful, but mm-hmm. when there is a second agent, it becomes highly virulent mm-hmm. and cause disease. This is the example of the bees. Bees recently have been shown to become very sensitive to pesticide if there are previous infection by a small carrion. So if they have both an infection and exposure to pesticide, they die.
Oh, and that was the problem that we had recently with the bee population?
Yes. But this is an example of another, you know, a concept which is very important in medicine now.
Yes.
Co-infection.
Yes.
And I tried to bring up this idea in AIDS with not much success, but I remember at a time where we had no very specific, very potent viral inhibitors, I could keep alive some patients with long-term antibiotic treatments acting on the co-infection by mycoplasma or bacteria, doxycycline.
In the AIDS cases.
In the AIDS cases.
And you did that in the 90s?
Yes, before the triple therapy was used.
The improvement in the antiviral. Before. Oh, I see. So you think, would you recommend that should still be done?
We should explore that now. We have new molecular tools and using the detection of signals mm-hmm. in many AIDS patients, not all, many HIV-infected patients. We find the signals coming not only from the virus DNA, but also for some bacterial DNA, especially in Africa.
You can distinguish viral and bacterial DNA.
Yes, by filtration. The size of the nanostructured anions is smaller from viral DNA than from bacterial DNA.
I meant, but not by...
Not by the signaling yet.
Yeah.
But then we can confirm by PCR, you know.
Yes, of course.
A specific PCR primers.
Yes. So you're finding this in Africa. I mean, again, going back to Saad's idea, which intrigued me, the syphilis must be present and widespread in the homosexual population, and it must be very widespread in Africa. That's a disease that's never been eliminated there. So I thought that it must at the very least be a significant co-infection.
Well, it may be not only one bacterial species, you know, several kinds of bacterial infections, because, again, in those cases of patients with HIV, we find common bacteria like Staphylococcus, Streptococcus.
Right.
So we should not only think of specific species, but there is bacterial infection inducing immune activation is the real phenomenon which activates HIV, which promotes HIV multiplication.
This would explain why Africa is, of course, why Africa is, because the population is so immune suppressed, the levels of sanitation are so reduced. Every aspect of public health is so low.
I'm always amazed because, you know, there is an obvious difference between the situation in Africa and the situation in the North concerning HIV infection. In the North, we have to see that most of the infection concern homosexual with number of partners and some drug abusers, not the general population.
Yes.
In Africa, it's an heterosexually transmitted disease.
Yeah.
60% of the new cases are women, infected women. Mm-hmm. So there is obviously a difference.
Yeah.
And when you raise that problem, they, you know, people think, well, the eighth establishment does not, it's not very concerned by this. It's, they are saying maybe because the sexual activity of African is much higher than the sexual activity, which is completely nonsense.
Yeah.
they don't realize this is a real problem which is not explained. Yeah. Of course, some have tried to explain this by co-infection, virus infection, herpes, genital herpes, and so on. It's true on the local, but there is more than that. And the difference seems to be at the bacterial infections are much more important and common in African patients. Of course, we have not made a statistical study, but, you know, as we are now making more clinical trials trying to cure the infection, so adding some supplementary treatments associated with the antiretroviral treatments, we can study this in more detail.
You have a clinic, or you have places where this is being tried
in
Africa?
Yes, our foundation, which is linked to UNESCO, has contributed to create a research center in Africa. We have one working very well in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, despite the political turmoil, and also in Cameroon, Yaoundé, and maybe also in South Africa, we are now new contacts. Mm-hmm. So it's a possibility, there is a possibility to do some clinical trial with a population of HIV-infected patients treated or not treated by antiretrovirals.
And you'll use the antiretroviral and also antibiotic
the,
combination?
Antibiotic we haven't started yet. We started in the early time, before we had the antiretrovirals. But it was a period of time in which clinician will not use anything else than anything but the antiretrovirals.
Oh.
So they believed that they could cure the patient.
Right.
But now, since they realize they cannot cure the patient, there are more, at least some have more open mind. So indeed, we can combine antiretrovirals, antibiotics, and maybe immunostimulant, because the immune system is not completely restored by the antiretroviral treatment. So we have to
treat the whole person. Really, we have to treat the whole nation, because Africa is, even after you cure the disease, the situation is so terrible in so many countries that you have to cure.
Yeah, but we have to start by one end.
We need to do it all.
This will spread to other problems later.
Yeah.
If we can cure AIDS, it will be a great achievement.
It will be a great achievement, yes.
You have other thoughts on outside of the DNA per se, but the way that the internal regulation is actually carried out in terms of, you mentioned it, the 7 Hertz cycle in the brain, but how that might lead to a different view of the organization of the whole central nervous system, and in fact the whole body as you know, capable of both producing and then receiving. See, the interesting thing is that both producing internally but also receiving externally, and at all these different scales. I'm wondering your thoughts on the difference of scale in terms of the receptivity of these low frequency radiations.
Well, I just ideas, that's all. That's probably the life has been constructed to receive the information from the outside, or signaling from outside, but also to protect against this. If we assume the electromagnetic signals participate to the harmony, or the unification of the organism, it has to protect itself from the external influence.
Mm-hmm.
So I would probably assume, this is just an idea, that we have some protection against the outside signaling. This explains why we can live with a background enormous.
Yeah.
It's interesting with our system, because it's very primitive, but we can detect the noise. And the noise in all large cities is very high.
Yeah.
Very high.
Yeah.
On the contrary, in Africa, it's very low.
Mm-hmm. The radio frequency.
The radio, noise. Well, the low frequency we are using for resonating the DNA.
Yeah. Well, you get the 60 hertz hum everywhere. Or for you,
the 60 hertz,
for you it's 50 hertz.
The 50 or 60 hertz, down to Professor Tesla, is everywhere now, also even in Africa.
Yeah.
But it's a very low magnetic field. But it's quite possible that he had some influence on the epidemics of bacterial infection by increasing the number of anions formed to persist. And why more in Africa? Why it should be more, of course, in our country than in Africa. It's not the case. So maybe they are counteracting waves. Which preventing the effect of the low frequency were generated by the electric power. And in Africa, you have mostly the electric power, not much so far, other sources of electromagnetic waves. This may change with, of course, the industrialization of Africa.
You think the seasonal, the expression of certain seasonal relations, relations to solar cycles in diseases?
It's quite also possible, you know, in the equatorial in equatorial regions, you have not exposed to the same magnetic field of the Earth than in the pole.
Yes, there are a lot of differences there.
So there are a lot of influence, and some are counteracting the others. It's why we are still alive. Possibly.
It's also interesting to think, as long as we're in the speculative realm of, you know, how you would maintain life outside of the electromagnetic field of Earth.
I wonder if we send somebody to Mars, what would be happen during the trip?
Right. Beyond just the cosmic
radiation.
Yeah,
we might have to supply in a gravitational field and also an electromagnetic one.
Maybe.
Artificial.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, there will be some waves for connection, of course. The astronauts will be talking with the Earth
radio,
by radio all the time.
Right.
I'd be curious, just in terms of your perspective, having actually done experimental work for so long, on how, you know, going really from the origins of molecular biology, discovery of DNA, you know, discovery of viruses and so forth. I know it's a sort of a broad sweep to take at once, but I'm just curious, having lived through it and worked through
Absolutely.
It, what your sense of, I guess, directions and the level of discussion, maybe, or the types of even just the experimental work itself, how it's changed, and you know, your sense of, particularly now with you know, what you might impart to a younger generation, which is sort of faced with these questions, but in somewhat adverse circumstances, I think, thinking about the future.
Well, as you said, I live with that from the beginning. I was very enthusiastic, actually. I was in a British laboratory at the time, not the Nobelix was discovered, it was a little bit before, but I attended a course of biophysics at the Queen's King's College in London, where the first X-ray diffraction experiments were done by Maurice Wilkins and Adrian Franklin. And I could see the small apparatus to stretch the fibers, you know, of DNA, the B form, the DNA hydrated, the hydrate B form, to show the first diffraction diagram. And we were taught to how to build up some molecular models, you know, with the double helix. So I was actually at that time I was working on double-stranded RNA. You know, I was looking for a double stranded RNA in the replication of RNA viruses.
You were looking already for a double stranded
RNA? I was the first to publish with my boss in Nature a paper called The Replicative Form of Encephalomycosis carditis virus RNA, which was a double-stranded form. I work on the double-stranded RNA.
But you already knew it was double-stranded?
No, I was looking for it.
What made you think that it would be?
Well, at that time, there were several models for replication of RNA, you know?
Ah.
And some people, as Saul Spiegelman, thought RNA, and like DNA, could replicate by having the same strand. Mm-hmm. One strand makes the same
mm-hmm.
strand.
Mm-hmm.
In case of DNA, the strand makes a complementary strand.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was to one model was that, but looking for this, that if there should be a complementary strand, we should find some double-stranded RNA inside the cells, and I found that.
That's fascinating. What year was that?
Huh?
That
when?
Was 1953?
It was published in 1963, yes, published in Nature.
In 63?
1963. Oh. Uh-huh. And this RNA was relatively easy to isolate because it was RNA is resistant, and I have a model of infectious RNA. And this RNA, of course, double stranded RNA was also infectious. The single strand was, but also the double stranded RNA was infectious as well. So just by looking at that infectious peak being RNA resistant, I could detect this double stranded RNA.
Hmm.
So this was my first, I would say, fait d'arme
right.
in the field of research. And so I was at the first phase of molecular biology. Then I was more oriented on the protein, membranes, cancer in the 80s, in the 70s between the 80s. So I did not miss completely by... I didn't participate myself very much in the clone, molecular cloning, you know, and so on, the restriction enzyme, and so on. But mm-hmm. I follow the field very carefully, mm-hmm. and I have some people in my lab working on that. But my first, I was very impressed by molecular biology, and people solve many problems. But now I think we are. Well, there is still some, developments of microbiology was very interesting. I'm not denying it. But I think we are going to a new phase, using new paradigms, including the waves. And I think the new biology should, of course, include the old molecular biology, which contact between atoms, particles, but also waves as well.
Oh, what do we call this? Do we have a name for it yet? Is it wave
Jacques Bérénice called that digital biology.
Oh, digital biology.
Digital biology.
So much. That refers to a specific application he had. But maybe wave biology.
Wave biology, something like that, yes.
If we get a good name.
Greek roots, we have to look at Greek roots. Maybe. But yes, I think we are bringing something, you know, new to explain precisely what molecular biology cannot explain. You know? We can have an analytical attitude, which is to dissect, to say what kind of genes, you know. Now we have the fast DNA sequencing, which is something also very important, you know, can sequence billions of nucleotides in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
But this is now applied to see, you know, we can sequence the genome of cancer cells, compare it to a normal cell and see the difference. But so what? Doesn't explain how this is constructed, how this originate. And my view of cancer is that, you know, whatever you do against cancer cells, you know, whatever chemo or radiation you can do, the cells is able to use all the possible solutions in the genome. So the cell will find a solution to resist to the treatment you are addressing to.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way to prevent cancer to prevent the condition of cancer. Once you have a cancer, it's very difficult to get rid of it.
Well, speaking of, you mentioned the digital biology. Did Jacques Benveniste overextend himself with that? You know, I read the claim. I remember reading about Benveniste first in 1988-89. It was clear to me that he had been very unjustly attacked. That episode with that idiot from Nature magazine, and they brought the magician. That was a disgrace, an international disgrace. But then I read, then later into the 1990s, he made the claim. This is what I read. I mean, I'm sure you know the truth. That's why I want to ask you. I read that he made the claim that, yes, it is a signal, and in fact, you know, we could record the signal and we could transmit it over a telephone line or some other system. And then there were attempts to do it, and from what I read, they didn't succeed. Is that true, that they didn't succeed, or maybe they really
did? Well, they did succeed in some cases, not always.
Uh-huh.
And I was very skeptical at that time for this kind of experiments. I accepted the high dilution effect, but not the digital transmission. But I found the same.
No, I know. This is why I'm not talking.
I found the same. Actually, we can. Yes, we can. We can transmit to internet a recorded signal and reproduce the DNA.
So
from that signal.
The reason for his failure was just some technical problem.
I think he was working on a biological system, you know, and he was looking for a biological effect of a molecule.
Right.
And of course, you can always criticize because the biological effect would be similar, identical. You can always say it's not exactly. With DNA, we can. We can see if we can transmit the sequence. Some people speak about teleportation. It's not exactly teleportation.
No.
But yes, we can. If we get a proper recording of the electromagnetic signal coming from the water.
Well, have you done that?
Water dilution, we have done it, yes.
You have done it?
Yes.
And you have actually recreated a sequence?
The DNA sequence.
Really? So then that shows that and what is the form of the recording?
What is the form?
The recording, what is the recording?
The recording is
audio?
On a computer. It's an audio call. Yes, it's audio.
It's a signal on a computer. I mean, is it processed?
It's a processed signal.
It is a
processed like music.
But it's Fourier synthesized. Now, the reason I ask is I'm wondering, the question in all of this is, do we have the whole signal? We see that we detect a 7 hertz, we detect certain harmonics
of that. It means we have the complete signals, of course. You have first is analogs, and then you have to convert it to digital for transmission, and then reconvert again from digital to analogs to retrieve the DNA. So it's a very complex system.
Oh, okay. So it's like a music CD. It's been digitally recorded and played back. But then it means that it is the. Since our detector is a radio frequency, it means it's the radio frequency that's the critical thing here, not other frequencies that we were talking about before, like the light or the infrared or an electric field.
It's just in the range of
low frequency.
7 to 20 kilohertz.
We looked at the work of a Russian biogeochemist named Vladimir Vernadsky. You know, he took a couple of these key things, for example, isotope fractionation. He thought that there was something much more significant about the state of the living organism, the living state, that was projecting itself in something like isotope fractionation, that it wasn't simply mechanical. He also did a very deep study. The whole last part of his life was looking at Pasteur and Curie's work on dissymmetry. The dissymmetry of optical active isomers, and you know, he thought that this expressed again something fundamental in the living state, which distinguished it from the non-living, and you could see expressions of it. You could see it in the biosphere as a whole, in the creation of new forms and more intensive migration of different chemical elements. But he thought that this could be a point of collaboration to rework a lot of fundamental concepts, but do it from the standpoint that, you know, often what you see living systems are capable of carrying out can only be done at the extremes in non-living systems. You know, the sorts of things like superfluidity, or at least analogs of things like superfluidity, chirality, and so forth, require extreme, you know, conditions to get in the laboratory, whereas they seem to occur effortlessly in the organism. And it just seems that there's something about that idea that I think was lost, and a lot of avenues that could have been pursued, you know, from the 30s onward were, I think, maybe now only starting to rediscover, but it seemed like a lot of ground was lost when we lost that idea.
Hmm. Yes, it's a very strange world in which science seems to expand, but not the ideas. The concepts are shrinking. Science is expanding, but the concepts are shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
In biology, and as you said, in physics as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's more and more empirical data, but less.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was thinking, now we are going to a world we are seeking new source of energy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Fission, nuclear fission is not, of course, a solution, but maybe fusion will be.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Robert comes again, the idea of cold fusion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an expert, but I think some physicists are thinking cold fusion
mm-hmm.
is possible, and especially coming from Russia. So maybe there should be an excitement to develop, you know, by looking new source of energy, we may develop new concepts, perhaps.
You said the imperative might force a new...
The empirical needs may force people to come back to old new ideas.
Yeah, we've thought a lot about this, that you know, this is really the way to think about national policies, that a true... You know, in the true national interest is pushing exactly those kinds of programs where you don't necessarily know what the research is going to give you, but it's a driver. You know, we had saw elements of it with the space program in a limited way, but the idea is you define a mission, and in the course of trying to carry that out, you will find a whole sciences branch out and open up.
So, I think the state government or the you know, the world nation should have set up some kind of a Manhattan project, not to make an atomic bomb, but to make new source of energy coming from nature.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this will come. But this implies that our politicians are sensitive to the to good scientific advisors, not the ones which are routinely around the politicians, which are just trying to, you know, to go along the lines of the politicians, the short-term lines.